We move on to rate regulation. I give the floor to Neil.
All right. To start with, we're looking at agenda paper 9A. So this paper explores the interaction of the model with the requirements of IFRS 3 business combinations. At a past meeting in November 2018, the board asked staff to conduct further analysis on the potential interaction between the model for regulatory assets and liabilities and IFRS 3 to determine whether an exception to the recognition and measurement principles in IFRS 3 should be granted for acquired regulatory assets and liabilities. Specific questions were raised about the costs and benefits of not providing an exception and the subsequent measurement issues that could result. And so this paper attempted to set out responses to these concerns. Paragraphs 8 through 27 of the paper consider the potential differences between fair value measurement and the measurement principles of the model, and note that differences in outcomes are likely to primarily result from the selection of different discount rates under the two approaches. The paper also illustrates the impact of having versus not having an exception to the recognition and measurement principles of IFRS 3 on the financial reporting for the acquisition and discusses some of the costs that entities would face in determining a fair value measurement. Paragraphs 28 through 32 of the paper then go on to explore the subsequent measurement issues that could result if an exception is not granted. So to summarize, the staff feel that providing an exception to the recognition and measurement principles of IFRS 3 would reduce costs for entities and provide consistent initial and subsequent recognition and measurement for acquired regulatory assets and liabilities with relatively few drawbacks. It would also be aligned with existing exceptions in IFRS 3 for other acquired items with unique recognition or measurement requirements, a few examples of which are set out in the paper. And the analysis in the paper also highlights the fact that the board has already tentatively concluded on the need for an exception to the model's measurement requirements for items of expense or income that will be included in the rates charged to customers only when cash is paid or received. For these items, it would follow that given this exception, an exception would also be required to the principles of IFRS 3 for at least these items. However, if a broader exception was provided for all acquired regulatory assets and liabilities, this would avoid the need for a two-tier approach where some items were granted an exception and some were not. And so with that, I'd like to pause to invite comments on the analysis.
Yeah, I think it's a very good paper, and I agree with the staff recommendation because there's a right balance between cost and benefits.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay, Daryl. So you essentially provided us with two options in the recommendation, and I'm in the space of the second recommendation. Just a little bit of my thinking here. I think that as you mentioned earlier in the paper, one of the main reasons that's going to cause the acquisition price to differ from the carrying value of the underlying asset or liability is going to be discount rates. And so essentially what that implies is that the company, the acquiring company, is either paying up because there is a higher than expected underlying interest rate, so they're paying to get those future cash flows. Or if the interest rate is lower in that circumstance, they will be paying less, they'll get a discount on the acquisition price, and then they will, as a consequence of that discount, the discount essentially recovers those lower interest rates that they've essentially paid. Now, I take the point that you've made about there being exceptions in, I think, IS 12 and IS 19 in IFRS 3. I think the places where we haven't made exceptions is probably more important for me in thinking about this. And I think where we haven't made exceptions is where we think that the extra income that you have bought, or the extra income that you, or the lesser income that you've got a discount for, is part of that key income line. So revenue, lessor accounting, IFRS 9, etc. I think we've done that because we recognize that buying future income is not really future income. And so for me, I would have said, at the very least, from the perspective of the interest rate differences between the two numbers, because that is going to be a key part of the acquisition price and because it does constitute buying future income, I would put consistency with other top-line income standards as the more important indicator here. I think there are going to be many circumstances where it's not material, but I think where it is material, it is very relevant to understanding the outcome of the accounting. So I would have said I'm comfortable, I understand why we have to do it in certain circumstances, but I think specifically doing it for interest rate means that we're making another exception for this industry from other top-line income numbers, and I just don't think it's warranted.
So you're saying you agree with sort of question two then?
Yes.
I could have limited my response to saying that I'm agreeing wholeheartedly with Martin. But I feel I want to respond to Darrell's comments also. I haven't checked, but I think where we do not have exceptions is where we have either a fair value measurement going forward or when we have a cost accounting going forward, so that we don't have exceptions when we are not affecting the reporting of performance going forward. So now I agree with you that there is this gap in discount rates that, by the way, the paper highlights very well. And I prefer to, I don't expect that to be massive, because if it were massive, then it would not be the regulatory rate that would be retained. We would, the requirements in the measurement would move us from that rate. So I don't expect that the impact is going to be significant, and I prefer to have this impact in goodwill than in future performance. Because I think, well, and so I'm really in favor of the exception as formulated in paragraph 46.
Can I ask, so I think I agree with you on the rates. If the date of initiation of the underlying contract is the same as the date of the acquisition happening, but clearly interest rates change over time. So so what you would very often end up with is a historic interest rate captured in the underlying and a current interest rate captured in the acquisition price.
But my understanding of what we do in the measurement is that we are in a current measurement. So if at a point in time the regulatory rate would not be changed while there have been market movements, we would be led to move away from the regulatory rate. No.
The model is that you set the rate on initial recognition, which in the majority of cases would be the regulatory interest rate. But those interest rates do change over time because the regulation tends to reset them at intervals. And
true.
So, yeah, so subsequent measurement, we would stick with the discount rate at initial recognition, but when those rates get reset by the regulatory agreement, we would use the reset.
If they get reset, it will be a current rate, but if not, it wouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Historic rate, yeah.
Tom?
I agree. I think just what Francois said about goodwill, I found that was missing here, and that when we write it up and put it out, we should be complete. On balance, I agree, but I am slightly troubled that in both cases, when I looked at example one, if it's valued at 100, it's valued at 109.2. At the end of the 5 years, at the end of this regulatory thing, it's gone. But if we do the 100 and we put the 9.2 in goodwill, it sits there potentially forever. And I'm slightly troubled that we're taking something that should be gone in 5 years, and it's going to stay there potentially forever. And on balance, I still think you're right, and I support it, but I wouldn't mind when we write it up whether this should at least be flagged so that somebody could comment if they had a different view on this.
May I ask a clarification? When we would recognize those assets liabilities at acquisition, we would consider that it is initial recognition.
No. Would you? You wouldn't. I think your question is, would you be resetting the rate?
No.
Because of an acquisition?
No, I think what we're saying is that we would be using the regulatory rate, except as we said in the previous paper on the general measurement model, that if there are some weird things happening, that the regulatory rate is not adequate, we'd be thinking of a different rate.
The rate was too low at the date of acquisition, you'd recognise a loss, but if it was too high, you'd recognise profits.
Right.
It's not initial recognition for the entity?
Sorry, could I? I think, Francoise, if I'm looking at example one in the paper, I'm going to see if this is what you're asking. If you regard the acquisition as being the initial recognition date from the perspective of the acquirer, are you saying, wouldn't you then set the rate at that date and therefore determine... Are you asking, are you evaluating the adequacy at the acquisition date, which may be in year two of a five-year reset period? Is that your question?
My understanding is that, and that maybe I'm wrong, that we would apply the measurement requirements, and the measurement requirements are that you depart from the regulatory rate if it's not sufficient at inception.
Happen on the acquisition?
But to me, this is inception.
Yeah. Well, it's essentially a new inception date.
Yeah.
And I think if I'm correct to Tom's point, if I have paid more for the numbers than what they're actually, if I paid more for the asset because of the higher interest rate, that more would not be applied to the assets. It would instead be applied to goodwill. If I've paid less for the assets because the interest rate is actually below the market rate or below my recovery rate, that would also be applied to that. Paying less would cause an adjustment to the value of the assets, so I'd drop the value of the assets. Is that right? So it wouldn't be applied to goodwill in that circumstance, and that's that initial recognition issue.
I think it depends whether an exception is granted. So if an exception is granted and you're applying the principles of the model at the acquisition date, then you would select a discount rate as normal. It would either be the rate in the regulatory agreement, unless that rate was not adequate, in which case...
So it's like initial recognition.
Okay, so that's...
So that's provided an exception.
So I don't change my view in any way.
Because, again, one of the issues that we have that in the normal model is that it's difficult to find... to understand what is a market rate, because we have the regulatory rate and it's not a market sort of situation. And one of the arguments for the staff's recommendation is that if on day one you are trying to find a market rate to base the fair value, there's all of the costs and complexity there. That would be your... If that was to happen, that would be your rate on initial recognition that you would then stick with. Except if the rate is then reset by the regulator subsequent to that, you have to do the adequacy assessment at the date of the reset, and then you have the subsequent measurement difficulty with, well, if I adjusted the regulatory rate on initial recognition for the perceived market rate, how do I deal with that then a year or so later if the rate is reset? And I think that's different from...
Absolutely. And I mean, I suppose my general response would be every time an acquisition occurs, our standards require you to do that analysis. And I think a part of the assumption is that if you are paying for something, this being paying for the assets, you've made some sort of assessment of what you think it's worth paying, so you've made an assessment of that interest rate.
Jen Chow.
Yes, thank you. I want to say I support the staff's proposal in paragraph 46. I think it's the right way to, as Martin said, very easy and less costly. And I think it's very easy to be understood, because the difference, if we require them to account those regulated assets and liability at fair value at acquisition date, what's the underlying concept? Because this is very typical assets arising from timing differences. They cannot be sold independently. So if we look at the conceptual framework, when we select the fair value or historical cost, what's the factor we should consider? First factor is whether it is sensitive to the market factor. I don't think it's sensitive because, and secondly, how this asset liability contributes to the future cash flow. And this asset have to, because we adopted a so-called supplemental model, they have to combine with other PPE, other assets to contribute future cash flow. So in this case, I think in order to provide more meaningful information to the users, I think the best way is to do is that just the carry forward, the carry amount, which recognized at the acquirer as a balance sheet. I think it's the right way to do, yeah. And the users will be very easy to be understood, yeah. This is not acquired to be sold, the cash flow is different, yeah.
Nick?
So obviously we always need to be careful considering exceptions, but here given the nature that these are incremental rights and obligations, I think it's very clear on a cost-benefit basis, I'd support the staff recommendation here.
Gary?
Yes. Actually, much the same. I think paragraph 26, you had said most of the time the fair value in the regulatory value are going to be roughly the same number. So given I accept that as accurate, and so why complicate things by rediscounting a number that's already discounted when you're dealing with a very highly regulated industry where open market rates are not quite the same in this environment? I'm not even sure I would consider it an exception, but we have to tidy up loose ends. And if you look at the two exceptions you cite in paragraph 37, income taxes, employee benefits are very different from the ordinary course of business operating assets and liabilities. And I think this probably fits the same mold, so I think good paper and good conclusion.
Mary?
I think I'm in the same place as Daryl in terms of saying I would limit the exception to the items that are already an exception to the model. And I think it actually would be pretty simple to do because I think that the principle that the board agreed for those cash items is that you measure the regulatory asset based on the measurement of the regulatory of the underlying item. And if the underlying item is, for example, income taxes, for which an exception already is provided in IFRS 3, saying that you measure, that carries through to the measurement of the regulatory asset or liability, is just saying that that requirement for measurement to be based on the underlying flows through IFRS 3 accounting. And the reason I don't support the broader exemption is the economic one that Daryl explained, because if you look back at example one, and this kind of comes back to Tom's comment, I'm an acquirer, and let me say I'm a financial acquirer, and I look at this and say, okay, I'm willing to pay more because I'm going to get something that has a value of 9.2 in terms of spread, and I know, I quantify that on day one. So basically, the exception that the staff is proposing is debit goodwill 9.2, credit income over the first 5 years 9.2, and so it's using purchase accounting to buy future margins. And when we encounter that in inventory, we said we don't do that. As one example, and the other kind of from a qualitative characteristic perspective, the exceptions that we give, as Gary said, are relatively, although income tax stretches this, relatively isolated areas of a company's accounting. When we have faced this issue before for core operations, we've deliberated a number of times for insurance about why we do not give relief on acquisition in terms of carrying through the acquiree's classification and accounting for the contracts. And so because this is an exception that maybe in the scheme of the population of all entities is, as Gary said, relatively contained, but in the focus of the reporting by these entities, by rate-regulated entities, is their core operations. I think giving a sweeping exemption from BizCom accounting for their core operations is not appropriate. So I'm in item two. The alternative discussed in the second question, and further, I don't think it's the kind of ongoing problematic problem that we've seen elsewhere about day two accounting, because I think the staff has laid out well in example one that it's related to the rate, and you know, in this kind of problem is related to the rate, and when it's related to the rate, it doesn't get factored into day two as a re-estimation of the cash flows. It comes in when the rate resets, and so therefore, oh, don't go overboard. and so therefore, I don't think it has that immediate day two reset issue. It comes in what I think, as example one shows, in the appropriate time period, given what it is that you bought.
Thank you. I agree with the step recommendation. Just one small clarification. On the exception to recognition principle. So basically, in terms of recognition or derecognition issue, you expect such change of recognition to derecognition or recognition, not recognized but recognized later. This kind of thing happen frequently.
So we provided two examples in paragraph 31, which are both related to the measurement, but the basis for conclusions to IFRS 3 discusses the fact that recognition exemptions were granted for IAS 12 and IAS 19, not because they were immediately necessary per se. There was some specific instances where they might be, but it was more for the almost for the avoidance of doubt that you go to those standards when accounting for a business combination. And so we were thinking along the same lines as those standards, and we did envisage some potential scenarios where the right or obligation is maybe just below, more likely than not, and therefore wouldn't qualify for recognition under the model, but may still have a fair value if an exception was not granted, and so would still be recognized in a business combination and subsequently need to be derecognized. So it was more out of caution that we recommend an exception to both, and also to be consistent with IAS 12 and 19. So, okay, that you. Answers your question.
All right.
So, and then we vote.
I'm in the same camp as Daryl and Mary for the reasons they gave.
Okay. Can I see who agrees with the recommendation in question one?
10.
So move on to paper 9B now. So again, in previous meetings, board members have asked how an entity should apply the model to situations where the regulatory agreement is set to expire and must be renewed, or where it can be terminated by one or both parties. This paper presents our analysis in response to these questions. Paragraphs 11 through 31 present an analysis of the application of the pertinent guidance in the conceptual framework to this issue, and a discussion of some precedents and other standards for similar situations. Paragraphs 32 through 37 discuss and illustrate the application of the model's principles to such situations, including the need to establish what we've termed the regulatory agreement boundary and some of the factors to consider and judgments that may be involved in doing so. And the remainder of the paper goes on to discuss some of the applicable disclosure considerations and the potential interaction with IFRIC 12 regarding this issue. And with that, I'll just pause for comments on the analysis.
I think it's good that you bring out some of the considerations that an entity would properly have about whether or not a cancellation, you know, is substantive. And, you know, it could be as simple as the mechanic of there's a two-year notice period or the time it takes to transition. But I did feel as the analysis went through the different scenarios, that it went from is there a substantive right to starting to address the probability that renewal would be granted, when you started talking about the uncertainty, you know, and how the guidance already agreed for the consultation about evidence. Sorry, I'm mangling the words here, but that we already have guidance in that says more likely than not.
Right.
Frankly, I had taken that existence uncertainty guidance as being in the context of a binding agreement existing. For example, you know, our old favorite storm damage. You believe it would be covered under this, but you haven't had specific approval of the amounts or that it's been prudently incurred. And so, therefore, you apply the more likely than not in the context of having a binding agreement. I did not think we were agreeing to extending the more likely than not for existence uncertainty to the whether or not there is a binding agreement in existence or there will be a binding agreement in existence. That is one of the scope requirements for being inside the model. So I would not have thought that the more likely than not extends to considering whether or not it will be an agreement will be extended to cover the period in which your timing difference, your regulatory differences reverse. So I agree with the part of the analysis that looks at whether or not cancellation on either party's part is a substantive, you know, a genuine right. But I would not go further, as the analysis does, to say that more likely than not is also how you determine whether or not an agreement or renewal will be granted, so that the agreement, you know, so that the binding agreement is deemed to extend to the period of the expected reversal of a regulatory difference.
Can I just check I understand what your point is there, Mary? You're talking about example three, is that right?
Let me see if I am.
What page is that, just to help us?
That's on page 14.
Clarity about whether this... Well, it's characterized as substantive, but I think it is how it would operate and whether... I don't know, Peter. Give me a minute and go on to somebody else's comment, and I'll come back to you with which of the scenarios.
Daryl.
So two things. First thing I just wanted to raise... Understand what we are thinking of actually doing with this analysis. Is this something that we'd pick up in the basis? Because what we're essentially saying is that we're not going to put anything anywhere in the standard itself. Is that right?
I think that's open to comment whether application guidance is needed or whether it's sufficient to explain the logic in the basis.
I think it probably relates a little bit to Mary's question here, because I think if I understand where you're going, Mary, it's whether or not we are saying we're going to leave the standard to be on its own, and therefore people will need to make a conclusion about whether or not rights and obligations outside of the contract term should be included or not. Or whether we're going to put something in the basis and actually say we think that those are or are not included, as the case may be.
I think if we put something in, it needs to be in the application guidance, not in the basis. I mean, we plan to think about it in drafting. My inclination at this stage is that it'd probably be helpful to include something in the application guidance, but we need to think a bit more about which examples we're going to propose including.
And then, Mary, I'm not sure if you want to finish the point or if I should go on to my next one.
Go on to your next one.
Okay. I thought the paper was quite a useful analysis. I understand where Mary's coming from in terms of slight reservations about that, and that's hence the question about whether we need to just give people a nudge in the right direction one way or the other might be useful in this. I thought the pointing to other standards was also quite useful. But I just perhaps wanted to raise a little bit of a caution, because I'm not sure that the examples always read across to the quotes from the other standards, and I think particularly it wouldn't be me if I didn't point out the IFRS 17 connection, but I think particularly on the IFRS 17 one, I know this is a topic that's been quite a hot topic of discussion and debate back and forth, and I just caution anybody picking up the paper that we've discussed this particular contract boundary issue at length at the TRG, and suggest anybody who wants to look for references, the TRG papers are probably the place to go.
We've discussed this with the insurance team as well, mostly since the paper was written. And certainly if we included anything like this in the application guidance, we'd need to look very carefully at the wording. But we think the substance, if I can use that word, of the thinking is broadly consistent at least.
I think the problem with a lot of this is it's at the detail level that it really matters, and this is a very high level.
Now, Peter, going back to your question to me, it was partly scenario 3, but it was also scenario 1. And while in the context exactly as written, I can see why the conclusion in scenario 1 would be that it's not substantive, it actually seems unlikely to me that a regulator would write every 10-year contract renewal if they then couldn't ever act on it, if the transition. Yeah. And so I think I walked away from reading scenario 1 as you apply the more likely than not to determine whether you're going to get renewed, rather than it being a conclusion that the renewal is non-substantive, because at the time you have to, the regulator has to give notice. They could never substantively transition to another entity. So I don't know if this is the actual fact pattern, and that actual renewal clauses are typically non-substantive. But I just worry that we're sending a message of use the more likely than not, which I took as reasonable guidance for what you do when the storm damage hasn't been approved, et cetera, to a much bigger scope issue.
So the more likely than not wasn't intended to be about what's the probability of renewal.
Yeah.
And the reason I mentioned scenario 3, which I think is the one where that comes up most directly, is that it's not about what you think will happen in the future. It's your assessment. And in this scenario, there's some uncertainty about exactly what the agreement means and how it's going to be interpreted. And so that's what we saw as a form of existence uncertainty. But it's not a forward-looking assessment of what will happen. It's trying to understand what the agreement says today.
I think if in the context of the basic question is the problem is that the reversal is outside the renewal, I think then the answer is no, that you don't recognize it, so long as you conclude that the end of the agreement is substantive. And having a lot of examples implies that there's a lot more mushiness in that than mushiness being a technical term.
Tom?
I think, as I understand it, in a lot of cases, these are renewed every 3 or 4 years. Is that right?
No, the rate is often reset the rate is assessed every, different intervals, but commonly 3 years or 3 to 5 years. But okay. The regulatory agreement stands. It's just the assessment of the rate happens that frequently. Okay.
So I guess it struck me that this is, to the degree that the regulatory agreement has a finite life, and you were toward the end of it, we absolutely need this. I mean, I think it would make no sense if all the things just fell off the face of the earth because we hadn't written a new agreement. But on the other hand, I think when I go back, one of the things that I was really keen on for this project was that it met the definition of asset or liability, and we could defend that. And so to the degree that we then, how do you interpret the establishes, I'm just reading from the definition, establishes a basis for setting the rate that gives rise to the entity's rights to add amounts to and obligations that amounts from future rates, suggests that we have to be pretty confident that thing's functioning for us to use that, to get us into the conceptual framework where I'd prefer to be. So I guess I just would think about making sure that we write it up correctly. I actually
kind of like Mary's thing, is that when you are coming to the end, a more likely or not might be a reasonable test.
But that was not my thing.
I will never use that, though. You do need something to assess whether you have an asset or liability when you've got a major potential partition. And I guess in my other one on this was, I'm sort of happier that you look to the next signing when you're pretty close and you have a long history and so on. I get a bit worried, and I don't know, it's not really covered here, but I have a question. What if you've got something like some sort of a decommissioning thing that's 30 years away, maybe four signings distant? Like, it seems to me, going back to the more likely than not, every time I have to rely on a future signing, it gets harder to make that jump. And so one of my questions is just how far can we look?
But what Peter said to me was, you don't anticipate future signings. You look only
at this one. And that's my concern then. What if the signing's a year away and it's looking pretty good? Surely we don't go out with a, you know, write off everything.
That's where the staff recommendation would lead you.
There is no staff.
If you don't have a right to renewal, that's where it will take you.
Yeah. I think the other thing to think about as well, I can't put my finger in the paragraph of the paper, but if there are termination clauses, we also have to look at what are the terms of the termination.
There's an example in here.
There is somewhere. Where it's, you know, it's not a case of you get to the end of the contract and the two parties walk away, because many of these, there's a huge amount of infrastructure involved in providing the service. So it's not easy to just set somebody else up to take on the regulatory agreement. There has to be a transfer of things across. And so we also need to look at what are the clauses there for the compensation if it is going to get transferred across to another party. So you might not recover these things through the rate, because if you're not providing services a long time in the future, but it's possible, looking at the facts and circumstances and the terms of the agreement, you may get compensated at the termination time.
Okay, we have to move on. Jen Chow?
Okay. First question, actually, same as the first question Dello mentioned. How can we, do with those analysis in for the draft? I agree with Peter's response. At least we should include in those analysis, especially analysis from paragraph 32 to 35 in the application guidance. Second, just a comment or question on the scenario 4 at page 14 and 15, there's an example there. Yeah. I think when we reach the conclusion that the entity has an enforceable right to recover those damage costs, something like that, I think this scenario is different from others. This is not only relied on whether there is a regulatory agreement or not, whether there is a damage cost or not. It's rely on the entity whether it can provide high quality service or not. So I think it should, based on that fact, if without providing so-called high quality service, I don't think the entity can have enforceable right to recover those damage costs, even there is agreement there. So I think this is slightly different with other scenarios. When we reach the conclusion, the entity has the enforcement right.
Well, the first point I would make is that, in my view, we need application guidance on the subject. The second is that I think I was among the board members when we discussed the scope, that thought that we didn't need much, but we needed a binding agreement. And so I'm very much in Mary's camp, if I understood exactly what Mary said. That to me, those rights and liabilities exist, provided that the binding agreement exists. And I would not take the uncertainty, I would not factor the uncertainty anywhere. It either exists, and I take all the consequences that are with this binding agreement, because when you talk about termination clause, to me, these are part of the binding agreement, so I take them into account.
Yeah.
But to me, that's also the limit to my recognition abilities in terms of rights and liabilities. So you ask if, as for comment, I think we need to see that back with a recommendation, and we need to have this in the standard. And these are questions that have been raised by people that follow what we do, and I think they're expecting more than some commentaries in the basis for conclusion, and the discussion here shows that we have a decision to make.
I think that this discussion for me shows it's going to be a pretty important area of the requirements. I think we will need to help people with application guidance. But the reason why I put up my card was sort of to make a special plea, which is that I think some of the trickiest application questions around some of the other standards, like 16 for lease term and 17 for contract boundaries, sort of touch on, you know, close cousins, if you like. And so I think we need to be a really special request that you work really closely with the sort of relevant teams there to make sure that the wording that we use here is consistent where it should be consistent and isn't the same where it shouldn't be the same, because invariably people are going to read across, and we're going to have to be careful of not to have knock-on consequences in other places of using the same words differently or different words, you know what I mean. I think we're just going to have to be very careful.
But just on that question of whether we need to bring something back for you to discuss at the board meeting. So the view we took was that with the recommendation, what we're doing is basically taking something the board has already decided, which it has to be a binding agreement, and applying that principle. I think if we proposed extending it a bit further to include possible renewals or likely renewals or anything like that, then I think we would definitely have needed a decision from you. So if you're happy with this as the direction, what I'd suggest is we put together the examples in drafting and see how you feel about that. So obviously, if you want to go in a different direction, that would need a decision.
But, I mean, I'm not sure I understood what you said, but when Mary pointed to example three, example three, to me, I read exactly, I think, as Mary did, which is that it seemed that the more likely than not recognition criterion for individual timing differences, you were, in fact, transferring the existence and certainty of the binding agreement to the timing difference. And that's not something that I would do. The binding agreement exists. I'm in the scope. The binding agreement does not exist, or there is an uncertainty as to its existence. I'm out of the scope. So I stop recognizing anything.
Maybe we should ask the staff to have a look carefully, and I think alert is that it's, I think, a high potential for a sweep issue to make sure we're actually all in the same place, because if we leave it to drafting, it's really difficult to get 14 different sets of comments and end up in a good place. So can we leave it at that? High probability of sweep. Dahl? Do you want to comment?
I understood that we are assumed there is a right to charge. This is not under dispute. The question is whether I will have time, room, to materialize this right in the future. Yeah. Look at the examples. I'm just wondering whether every time that you go for, and with looking at the FRIC 12 against this, every time that we try to include examples, despite might help, it also may develop some undesirable principles. I'm just wondering whether instead of including examples, just mention some indicators that might be taken into consideration in relation to the probability or not of materializing the right. I think that just making this more practical.
Gary?
Just quickly, just to clarify a question that I didn't have coming into the room, but listening to the discussion. We talk about the duration of the agreement. Are we only talking about recovery of regulatory assets and liabilities, or are we talking a bigger scope of assets and liabilities?
I think if I understand your question, Gary, I think we are talking about the right to be able to recover the amount of the timing difference that's arisen so far.
Yeah, but, I mean, regulatory agreements got finite lives, usually, or in some cases you have, where they renew indefinitely until someone breaches something. But there's a lot of assets that go decades. The hydroelectric dam lasts 100 years. I mean, that's assuming 10 renewals of these contracts, but we're not talking about those. We're talking about regulatory assets and liabilities. If we're going to go this direction, I think it's the whole balance sheet we're talking about, quite frankly. Nuclear power plants, transmission lines, pipelines, talking decades, some cases centuries, how long some of these things last. So I think we should have a practical solution that says if IS 37 doesn't come into play, that you really think the going concern type issues are there. I think we should address it, but this is a much bigger issue looked at from one way than just recovery of regulatory assets or liabilities. I mean, ultimately, in a regulated enterprise, every asset is a regulated asset, and they only exist because of it, but there might be many, many rate cases going forward to get them recovered. So I think we should address it, but I don't think we should make the biggest deal in the world out of this thing either, because I think common sense prevails. You're providing a necessary good and service to modern life as you know it, and it's going to go on. You know, whoever's got the enterprise concession might lose it, but the operating utility is going to continue.
Peter, do you want the last word? I'm conscious of time.
Maybe just a quick word on Gary's point. Just to remind you that what we're talking about here is, does the right or obligation exist, and what's the boundary of that particular right or obligation that we're accounting for in this project? Now, your dam, the entity's got the right to the dam. Of course, there's a separate question which is beyond the scope of this project of, is the dam recoverable and CGU testing and all of that, but we're just looking specifically here at the question of, does the right or obligation exist and how far out does it go?
Yeah, but that was my point. How far out does it go? And that's, I asked the question, is it the regulatory asset liability or is it bigger? And the answer was, it's everything. I think if I heard...
But the discussion here doesn't affect everything. It only affects that question of
determining. I would have trouble.
Extra thing.
Yeah.
But I would have trouble believing this discussion doesn't affect recovery of everything. Because we're talking about the end of a regulatory period or a concession period or something, and these assets need longer time than that to recover.
Okay. We've got what we need. I think it's going to be a tricky area. All right, so 9C.
Yep. So paper 9C analyzes situations where at the financial reporting date it's not yet certain whether an entity will become entitled to a bonus or liable for a penalty under the regulatory agreement as a result of the period over which performance is assessed concluding after the financial statements are issued. And we've referred to this period in the paper as the performance incentive period. And we note that this may also be an issue even if the periods are coterminous at interim financial reporting dates. Paragraphs 21 through 26 illustrate how the total allowed compensation for the incentive performance period may have to be estimated in such scenarios, taking into account the entity's expected or most likely performance against the incentive criteria. Once estimated, the total allowed compensation will need to be apportioned between the current and future periods. That is, it will have to be apportioned to determine which amount relates to goods or services already supplied. And once this amount is determined, the total allowed compensation can then be compared to the amount charged to customers to determine whether a regulatory asset or liability should be recognized. Paragraphs 30 9 through 45 of the paper go on to provide a short discussion on how information received after the reporting date might be incorporated into this estimation, and indicate that an entity would look to the requirements of IAS 10 to determine whether any subsequent events or information should be incorporated into the estimate of the total allowed compensation. And we're just looking for the board's comments on the analysis in this paper as well.
Mary?
Yes, if I look at the example on page 11, begins on page 10, example 2, at December 31st, the entity concluded that there is a 40% chance that it would earn the bonus. And then it goes on to say, however, in the post-year-end period, their continued performance combined with other factors, then presumably those other factors are post-year-end factors, leads it to revise its estimate of meeting the performance condition up to 80%. Now, the staff is concluding that IS-10 would tell you to push that 80% back to December 31st. I don't think it would, because the way this example is written, it reads to me as the increase from 40% likelihood to 80% likelihood is a consequence of events that happen in the 3 months to March 31st. Mm-hmm. So I would regard that as a non-adjusting event rather than as an adjusting event. Sorry, speaking very slowly so this didn't slur to be the wrong words.
Yeah.
So I agree with the staff's cite of IAS 10 as the relevant piece of general literature to assess the circumstances. I'm just not sure I'm on board with how you've looked at, and it may be partly the description, but how you've looked at the post-balance sheet events cause you to change your assessment of the probabilities being an event that adjusts the year-end assessment. And I think that has maybe some consequences for other standards. And I'm saying this very cautiously with Sue, in charge of the chair. I don't know if it's how I'd look at changes in credit loss expectations.
You'd have to look at it as at the reporting date, and we had a TRG discussion on that.
And I think there may be an element of just the wording that you've used here, because I wasn't clear from the example whether what you meant was there was a 40% chance based on the performance that already happened, but the entity anticipated that it would perform in the future, because I think that is relevant in this circumstance. It is that, but it is the facts that exist at 31 December, the relevant ones, even if you are projecting forward.
We have to be so careful with what we put in these papers, because people are applying IS 10, obviously, and they'll pick these examples up and run around with them. Chung Wu.
Thank you. They are very good analysis, so they are very impressive. Just one question on that, the apportionment that's maybe related to paragraph 38. So we are taking some kind of over the period method to recognize something. But this is a kind of supplementary approach to IFRS 15 or the service concession agreement. So what I'm saying is that these two progresses are consistent each other if we do this kind of thing. They're always consistent with their percentage of progress based on the IFRS 15. They recognize all regular revenues. But we are considering some kind of regulatory income based on this something, but it's not clearly stated here. But
yeah, I think the intention was an entity will have to consider the facts and circumstances and how it goes about the apportionment, and we don't want to be overly prescriptive about how that would be done. It's not always going to be appropriate to apply a strict time apportionment basis, for example, if perhaps the bonus relates to an amount per unit delivered, then the apportionment could be made on that basis, or there may be other factors to consider in how the amount is apportioned, the amount you expect to earn as a bonus under the agreement over the regulatory incentive performance period, how you apportion a part of that to the current period. So I think the intention is to leave it to leave it as a matter of judgment based on the facts and circumstances.
What I'm saying is specifically, if you apply IFRS 15, for the current period, you recognize 40% of a kind of a total contract amount. But based on this, some kind of indicators of anything, you recognize 35% of the regulatory income. Then this 40% of regular normal revenue recognized quite maybe different from this regulatory income. Because what I'm saying is the basic fundamental principle of our regular accounting is supplementing the revenue recognized over periods. So that's what I'm saying. They must be consistent, right?
Yeah. I think, Chung-Wu, you're talking about the variable consideration aspects of IFRS 15. Is that what you're doing a comparison with?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a high hurdle in IFRS 15 for that, which talks about you'd only book the revenue if there was a...
highly probable and likely to reverse.
Yes, so you're fairly certain. We did look at that, but we've had pushback before. There were certain reasons for that higher hurdle in IFRS 15, which didn't translate into this. But as Neil said, what we're trying to do is look very much at what are the facts and circumstances to the individual bonus or penalty that's involved and be as consistent internally in the model as we can be.
Jin Chao?
Okay. First comments, I have similar concern about example two as Mary mentioned. I think we should be very careful to use the example to illustrate what's the meaning of the IFRS 10. So my suggestion is that just silence this problem. If this is the event after the balance, after the reporting period, it automatically will IFRS 10 will apply, and it just let's prepare to make a judgment. If we do would like to develop example, I would like to make some changes. Actually, I made some changes how to, you know, to apply, comply, you know, IFRS 10, but I will not say that. Yeah, if you would like, I will illustrate how to make changes. Secondly, I have another question. If we look at example one, suppose the entity used the expected value method to account for that those bonus. So that means it will account for with amount of 55. And maybe a couple of months later, the company received the bonus because the amount will be different with the previous you recognized because you're based on expected value. So I would like to see how we account for that difference between the actual amount with, you know, expected value you already recognized. Whether it should be, you know, recognized as a profit or loss or whether it should be recognized as adjustment to the regular assets and the liability. I think we should be clear about these differences, how to account for those differences. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the staff's intention is that would be accounted for as a change in the estimated cash flows that we've addressed in the measurement principles already. So if previously you're estimating based on the expected value, you get 55, and that estimate is updated to 100, that would be accounted for as a change to the regulatory asset.
Francois?
Well, I would recommend that we have, I don't know what your intention is, but we have illustrative examples included on this issue. But I would not put the events after the closing date as part of them because I think don't think that it has anything specific in this issue that makes those examples necessary. And I thought we had, but I don't. Not able to date or even to pinpoint to it. Thought that we had at some point established that for binary outcomes, the expected value was not the best approach. So when you have, if you have an example where there is a binary approach, I think you should not say one or the other.
The model itself says use whichever one you think is most appropriate for the fact
to make sure the examples are consistent with that. Yeah.
Rika?
Thank you. I actually have the exact same question as Mary had, and I think this part should be fixed. But at the same time, I'm just wondering, because this is a kind of the mechanism to fill the gap between the existing IFRS model and the special supplement model. So within the example, if you can provide how you are trying to fill in the gap. I mean, currently, you just address the fact pattern and then start explaining about how to apply that new model. But before doing that, if what is the part we need to fill in by using this new model, people can follow the fact and what is necessary to be done with this model.
Okay, thank you.
So I'm sensing most people probably don't think we should include the post-balance sheet example. Is there any discussion of that?
Maybe just tell people to follow IS 10 as usual, full stop.
Okay, we're meant to be breaking now, but I suggest that we just keep going, and I'm hoping we'll speed up from here on in. So handing over to you for 9D.
We have now substantially completed discussions on all key aspects of the model, and in this paper, the staff recommend the board publishes an exposure draft rather than a discussion paper as the next consultation document for this project. The analysis supporting this recommendation is in Appendix B to this paper. As explained in paragraph 18, the staff prefer withdrawing IFRS 14 and develop a new standard for the model rather than amend IFRS 14. Does the board agree with the staff's recommendation to publish the proposed model in an exposure draft? If there are any questions or comments on the paper, those are also welcome.
So recommendation of an ED and proposing replacing 14. Any comments? Françoise.
And I support the issuance of an exposure draft on the basis of your analysis. And it's a detail, but IFRS 14, I think, would be totally replaced. So I would, the new standard would be IFRS 14.
The numbering.
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to keep the title because the title doesn't describe what we're trying to do, because IFRS 14 is regulatory deferral accounts. So that title doesn't describe what we're actually going to be accounting for in the model. So the title would definitely have to be replaced.
Yeah.
And then the question is, can you have a new title with an old number?
We're going to have a red book, blue book issue if we have two standards with the same.
Maybe easier to have a separate number.
But, Daryl?
So very similar. Support the idea of an exposure draft. I think, based on your analysis, based on the fact that I think we've developed a composite enough model that we can go out with that model as an absolute outcome, support the idea that we would do it as a new standard, not as a revision of IFRS 14, and I hadn't applied my mind to the number.
Yeah.
and maybe unnecessary because there seems to be support, but I think the point that you made in particular about the we're at the point when we need feedback on detailed drafting, not just concepts, absolutely convinces me. I think we're ready to, but I think we also need to be at the ED stage.
Okay, so with that, can we vote on question one, whether you agree with the recommendation to publish an exposure draft rather than a DP?
13, one absent.
Question two, that we develop a whole new standard.
13, one absent.
Okay.
Agenda paper 9E provides an initial assessment of the model's likely effects, which the board has considered in making tentative decisions about the model. In this paper, we highlight that the application of the model will affect financial statements of entities differently, depending on whether they are currently recognizing regulatory balances or not. We conclude that we expect the model would provide users of financial statements with benefits in the form of more useful information that would outweigh the costs of its implementation. The analysis in this paper supplements the due process steps taken to date that are discussed in Agenda Paper 9F. We are not asking the board to make decisions on the matters discussed in this paper, but ask whether the board has any comments or questions on this paper.
I did. Firstly, I think it's really good you've done this and put it in front of us. So well done, and I think it's a good analysis. I just had a couple of suggestions. One was in paragraph 17, I think you make a good point that clearly people will be affected quite differently depending on what their sort of starting point is, whether they're an A and B. And consistent with that, I wondered whether when we got to the cost section, whether there should be some differentiation that depending on where you're starting from, there could be flow-on effects. So I think in the rest of the analysis, we should think about where that could make a difference, just to follow it through. And my other sort of observation was on the financial stability bit that you touched on in the last few paragraphs of the effects analysis. I think one thing that we've done on a couple of the other recent standards, thinking of leasing and 17, was when we've talked about financial stability, part of what we've focused on is some observations on whether we think that the information provided would be helpful from a stability aspect in terms of improving understanding, better understanding of risks and et cetera, et cetera. And I think here we could probably, it would seem to me, that because there'd be better information about these regulatory assets and liabilities accounted for in a consistent way, people will be more aware of the risks associated with the obligations and the rights, et cetera, that these entities would have, which would be enable people to act on a more timely basis for making decisions and to manage risks, and we would think that that would contribute to financial stability. Anybody else?
Moving on to agenda paper 9F, this paper summarizes the due process steps taken today, and after paragraph 13 asks the board to approve a 120-day comment period for the exposure draft, give staff permission to begin the balloting process, and indicate whether any board member intends to dissent from the publication of the exposure draft.
So comment period, I agree with 120 days. Permission to ballot, I agree with the permission to ballot. I think this is the right time to go out. I think we've gone through a lot of decision-making. I agree, as I said earlier, that this should be an exposure draft, so I think that's all appropriate. When I think about the kind of the harder question, the dissent question, and this has been a little bit of a hard question for me in this particular standard, I think we need to get the standard out, which is important. When I thought about the standard at the first instance, I thought we had two objectives, and this is very much my personal perspective on the standard. And my two objectives in the standard were to recognize regulatory assets and recognize regulatory liabilities, and as a consequence of that recognition, for lack of a better term, regularize the income statement of these entities. And I think in large part that is what our proposals to this point have achieved. But I think, in my personal view, we have gone a little bit beyond this. And I think we've gone beyond it with the exceptions that we created last month in regard the way we treat certain assets and determine the value of certain assets and liability and how that flows through to the income statement. And I think the decision we made earlier today on IFRS 3 sort of puts me in the same place in terms of having gone beyond. So if I'd seen comparability of income statement and understandability, bearing in mind that some of these entities will have regular income as well, they'll have non-rate regulated revenues and non-rate regulated interest and potentially other income. So I feel like we haven't quite achieved that. I feel like we've gone beyond that. At the same time, what I said at the beginning, I think it's important that we get this out there and that we get people's views on it. So my position at the moment, and I'm probably exercising what I'd refer to as the tuck option. So tuck from time to time is sort of given a tentative conclusion at this stage of the discussion. I would like to think that we are going to be going out there and getting very clear feedback on whether or not we think that we've gone far enough or too far in the process, and specifically how these exceptions from what I would call regular order are actually being dealt with. And I think as long as my comfort here would be based on the level of description we've got around why we made the exceptions and how those questions actually play out in the end. But right now, I don't intend dissenting.
Françoise?
Well, I agree with the comment period, and I don't intend to dissent. I really believe in the improvements, benefits that you've described in your effect analysis. I'm happy to approve the permission to ballot, but to me, the boundary issue that we've discussed earlier, so Shu said definitely it has to be a sweep issue. I don't know whether sweep means that it comes after we have given permission, and then that's fine. But if sweep means it's a smallish issue, a small thing to look at, then I would prefer to permit balloting after this has been resolved.
All I mean by sweep is the way that I was using it, which may not be the technically precise use of the word sweep, but for argument's sake, is that I think it would be helpful from a project management perspective to give staff the go-ahead to start the drafting process. But I think that before we are asked to sign the ballot form in blood, that we should make sure we're all comfortable with how the scoping question, et cetera, that was raised today. So I'd like them to us to, if we're all happy, obviously if enough of us are happy, to give them permission to go and start the drafting process. But I'm flagging that I think we probably need to see a reanalysis of that paper to make sure we're all happy, because I'm worried that if we leave it to draft and we might not end up in the best place, it's better we have a discussion about it.
That's also where I am, but to me it's a must. Subject to that must, I'm happy to approve.
Tom?
This is similar to the discussion on goodwill for me. I don't understand 120 days. This has been going on for years. This was a major challenge. Some major stakeholders had major problems and very skeptical. We worked really hard to get it into the conceptual framework, because a lot of people just said, all you're doing is a matching. And I think we've got where we fit the conceptual framework. Additionally, just in this, almost every regulatory regime will have subtle differences in terms of how it will be applied, and that based on how the regulation is done. And there's translation and all those things, and I don't see after all this time doing 120, because it goes to the issue of legitimacy. After all this time, we're going to say, okay, and everybody hustle, do your translations fast, get everything in, because we got it just right. I just think when you're doing this kind of a change in a brand new standard, it should be the maximum and give people the maximum time to think about it. This is a brand new thing that a lot of people oppose. So I think we should be at 180 days. And then when we do get this out, and I think it's going to go out, I think it's going to be a good standard, I think it will be more legitimate if we've given the maximum time for people to respond, not the minimum.
I think we do have to be a little bit careful, though, because it is an exposure draft, and when we put IFRS 14 in place, we sort of implied it was only for a short period of time, and it's taken us a while. Also, I was struck yesterday by the comment periods that FASB was talking about and feeling a little bit envious. But Mary, Francoise, did you want to come back in specifically, or can Mary come in?
No, Mary, I
think we have got to the point where it's time to give the staff permission to ballot, but I think I am likely to dissent. I had some of the same concerns as Daryl, and he did a better articulation of them than I probably would, so I'll just incorporate his by reference and say that I just fell on the other side of that, particularly relating to the decision that we made recently about OCI, is I think I looked at this project as trying to quantify, to improve the usefulness of the financial statements by quantifying the impact of rate regulation on the amount to be charged. And I think when we expanded it to include the offset within comprehensive income, we went beyond that and I think kind of opened up that specter of getting some charges of pursuing matching as well. I also am troubled by the business combination decision that we made today, because it applies to the core of the entity's business rather than marginal, if you apply that generously, issue. And third, I still, something that is still bothering me, but I have not come up with a good articulation of exactly why, is the requirement, the fact that the scope in the definition of regulatory agreement does not capture that notion of the commitment to support the financial viability of the regulated entity. So that's the third thing that's kind of on my short list of why I'm concerned. I don't want to stop the process and debate it longer. I think we've bottomed out each of those issues in our debates, which is why I say give permission to ballot. The other thing I want to do is very much join in Tom's concern about pushing it to 120 days. I think I might split the difference between 120 and 180 at 150. But I think while those ultimately that will be affected, as you said, in the effects analysis are a relatively small population of entities, and they've been following this and they're eager for it and looking for it. I think that there should be others who we want to encourage to look at it, both with respect to are they captured inadvertently, are they national standard setters who were concerned when we embarked on this project, and the implications of some of the thinking for other areas that would not be within the scope, the kind of analysis we've done. So I think it's not like we're going out to a targeted audience and saying these are the only people who have to think about it. I think at this stage we'd want not just those who are rate regulated and assume that they're going to be captured to look at it, but I think also either some who might be on the margins and they want to think about why they would or wouldn't. And then I do add the translation issue, because I think it is looking at the specific words rather than kind of the general concepts that we're trying to get feedback on. So I'd look at doing something longer than the minimum 120 days.
Well, I think 120 days is the usual period for an explicit draft. And, I mean, if we were still aiming at issuing this by the end of the year, I would be tempted to give longer in order to take into account the timing in which it comes. But extending the comment period beyond the 30th of June to May does not accomplish anything. If we were to, it depends when we are really ready, but let's say extending beyond 120 days to May would keep in mind that it's not beyond the 30th of June. And so I think we have a community of rate-regulated activity people who are waiting for this, who have no really any question about whether these are assets and liabilities. I think that the team has done in this project a wonderful job in articulating this, in not making progress as long as we all together would be convinced. So I think there is a lot of material that will appear in the basis for conclusion that will be really educational in understanding what these things are that we are proposing to account for. So I would give precedence to those who are affected versus those who have an interest in understanding, and not delay the whole exercise on that account. I also I had another point I wanted to make, and I think I've forgotten it.
Darrell?
120 days is our norm, and I think we've used 120 days for a lot of complicated, intricate standards, and it's worked, and we've got sufficient feedback. I really think that we should be making exceptions to 120 days in very, very limited circumstances, and really when something jumps out. And I agree with Francoise that maybe a holiday, if it was over December holidays or over August holidays, that might be one rationale. But my view would be that we go with 120 days unless there's a real driving reason. And I think in particular, I'd be very reluctant to go for longer just because we think we have time for some reason.
I think there's one thing that would put me on the fence on about this, and that's that what we're talking about here may be a change in mindset for people. So it's not necessarily a big difference in outcome for some people, but it may be a big difference in mindset. So, I wonder whether 120 is quiet enough for that, possibly. But.
All right, let's vote. So, the first question is, does the board agree with the recommendation for 120 days?
10 were absent.
Do you give the permission to ballot?
Subject to?
12, one absent. Oh, 13, one absent.
And dissent. All right, thank you. So we're running a little bit late. I suggest we start again at 20 past 1.